In the coming week, NATO defense ministers meet to discuss withdrawing from Afghanistan. The UN Security Council debates Yemen following the Biden administration's policy shift. And spacecraft from the US, China, and the UAE arrive in orbit for Mars on multiple missions. It's February 11th, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, in the coming week, NATO defense ministers are scheduled to convene virtually. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg is set to chair the meeting. The two-day conference is set to cover a variety of topics, especially President Trump's decision late last year to reduce the number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan from roughly 5,000 down to 2,500. Joe Biden is president now, though, Bob. Does he have a different view on the wisdom of lowering U.S. troop levels in Afghanistan?
Jim, I think we know generally President Biden shares former President Trump's view about ending the so-called endless wars the U.S. had been involved in, especially in the post-9/11 frame of fighting the war on terror. So he was in favor of drawing down forces in Afghanistan. However, drawing down forces and completely removing U.S. forces by the May deadline are two different things. And the administration is signaling so far that the terms of the agreement in which the U.S. would withdraw don't seem to be met on the Taliban side. So the Taliban, by most accounts, has not targeted U.S. or NATO forces since the agreement was signed, but it has certainly been targeting Afghan government forces. And has also been making seemingly continuing ties with al-Qaeda, which is also not supposed to be permitted under the deal. So you have U.S. officials saying, signaling pretty much, you know, we're not there yet in terms of meeting the conditions for a U.S. drawdown. And so that then leaves questions of, so what next? Because the Taliban seem to be signaling, you said you're gone, you're going to be targets again if you don't observe this.
Bob, why is it that this is an issue coming up in a NATO meeting as opposed to simply being an issue for the U.S. government to decide for itself, since we're talking about the deployment of U.S. troops?
It's a really important time. It's a rather unusual time where you have NATO forces in Afghanistan actually outnumbering by 2-1 U.S. forces. So about 5,000 NATO forces, about 2,500 U.S. forces in Afghanistan. And NATO is looking to the U.S., as it has since the Afghan mission began, for guidance on where things are going. Should NATO nations be preparing to draw down their personnel? Is there something they should be syncing up as we head into the spring to come up with some sort of collective plan? Because they're also going to have targets on their backs as well as the U.S. if the Taliban decide that the deal is off. So there's very much an interest, let's say a self-interest, but also a collective interest. And the overall ongoing interest is hoping to leave Afghanistan some sort of a state of stability with the actors agreeing to sort out their differences and going forward. Now, that last part is couldn't be farther from happening, seemingly at this point. There is basically no so-called intra-Afghan talks going on right now. And so it's a question of, you know, what are the defense ministers going to be talking about in terms of their guidance from their governments about what should happen this spring? What will they collectively go back to the Taliban with? Or what is the sense of collective feeling about how the U.S. should be carrying through with the Taliban? And our colleague Max Boot has written on the website this week saying that it seems like Biden is likely to opt for an option of trying to get the Taliban to extend the withdrawal deadline while the intra-Afghan peace talks continue.
But what would that extension do, Bob? I mean, what's the rationale for it, given that it's pretty clear the Taliban is not living up to the terms of the agreement? What would the Biden administration expect to change just because it extended the deadline?
I think a number of things would have to happen. First of all, we should note that the main U.S. envoy, Zalmay Khalilzad, who has been serving as envoy under the Trump administration, has been asked to stay on by the Biden administration in the same capacity. So you'd have a leading, well-known actor involved. But then with that, really ramping up efforts, this is what's expected at least, really ramping up efforts to bring other countries in the region into the process to press the Taliban into permitting this agreement to be extended. And again, back to your question, what kind of extension are we talking about? I'm not sure whether, you know, we're talking about through the end of the year? Is it what's feasible? But clearly, with a dormant peace process right now and a sense that they'd want to have some sense of progress, they're going to have to come up with something realistic, but also something that satisfies the Taliban, who at this point feel like they're holding a lot of cards in terms of they see a sort of timetable-based withdrawal looming for their counterparts, and then also feel like they are stronger, more potent than the Afghan national forces, which they do seem to be. The Taliban in large chunks of the country now holds sway. And so it's a tricky time period, definitely.
So is the Biden administration merely delaying the inevitable? I ask that because you're quite right. The United States, for a number of years, through successive presidencies, insisted that it would withdraw from Afghanistan only if the conditions were right. Now we seem to have moved to a time-based withdrawal. The Taliban can read the American press as well as anybody else, given the internet. It's clear that Americans would prefer to have their troops home, not staying in Afghanistan. So how does the Biden administration get out of this diplomatic, political, military cul-de-sac?
Yeah, I mean, we've been sort of every week noting the thorny issues facing the Biden administration, and this has got to be in the first rank of them, Jim. I think, again, while there's that desire to draw down, again, it's more than 20 years now, or close on to 20 years, I should say, where the U.S. has had a force in Afghanistan after it initially ousted the Taliban in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. And we've had under this peace deal almost a one-year period now where there have been no U.S. fatalities. That's significant. And I think that was certainly something that President Trump tapped into and had a lot of support for domestically. So Biden seems to want the same thing. The question is, what is the threshold in which the Biden administration decides, all things being equal, you know, we need to leave this to the Afghans and we're leaving? And also, does it try to hold on to some sort of counterterror mission where it keeps some sort of forces, lighter forces in the region to be able to conduct attacks against other forces, let's say Al-Qaeda or ISIS, which continue to have a presence in the region?
Bob, that's an important point because over the course of the presidential campaign, then candidate Joe Biden said that he favored keeping a small number of U.S. forces in Afghanistan in this counterterrorism role because he is concerned, understandably, about the potential for resurgence of Al-Qaeda or of the Islamic State and then their ability to wreak havoc beyond Afghanistan. But it would seem that if the Taliban are allowed to take over government Afghanistan, it'd be very hard to maintain a counterterrorism force for the United States in Afghanistan. Those two seem to be incompatible.
They really do. And I believe in some earlier phase of the negotiations, there was some talk about the Taliban agreeing, you know, the Taliban as partners in a peace agreement alongside an Afghan government agreeing to some sort of U.S. counterterrorism presence. Again, if you have a wholesale Taliban takeover and the Taliban just says, you know, we're the battlefield victors, you know, the caliphate is back and we're setting it up. You're right, Jim. It's hard to fathom that other than if the U.S. gets, say, neighboring Pakistan to allow some basing. The U.S. used to conduct quite a few drone strikes, for example, in the borderland Badlands area. Maybe something like that happens. But otherwise, then you're talking about longer range air flights, which don't seem as palatable. So something's got to change. I still think there's a hope that you will have a semblance of the current civilian Afghan government, hanging on. But again, it's looking kind of grim.
Lots of policy options, none of them particularly appealing, Bob.
Well, Jim, let's stay with changing policy options, potentially, and go to Yemen, where there has been a, shall we say, intractable civil war going on for a number of years now. Last Thursday, President Biden gave a speech at the State Department in which he announced the U.S. would end its support for the Saudi-led coalition waging war against Yemen rebels, especially Iran-backed Houthis. Jim, can you give us some further background on what's going on in Yemen?
Sure, Bob. You put your finger on the important part, which is there is an intractable civil war in Yemen. It has also been a horrific civil war. It's estimated that more than 230,000 people have been killed since the civil war began back in 2014. As things stand, something on the order of 80% of all Yemenis face starvation, given the war and the interruption of normal life. As you mentioned, Joe Biden, in his first major speech, when he went to the State Department, announced that he was removing the Houthi rebels as a designated terrorist group. Again, this civil war in Yemen pits the Houthis against other Yemenis. The Houthis have been backed by the Iranians, and Saudi Arabia and other Arab countries have been on the side of the Houthis' opponents. Now, the decision by the Biden administration to lift the designation of Houthis as a terrorist group was done, so the administration says, precisely because the country faces a horrific famine. I should note that the Trump administration made this designation on its way out the door on January 19th, the day before President Trump stepped down as president, and it was immediately criticized by a wide variety of humanitarian groups and other aid groups on the grounds that it would prevent them from providing the sorts of relief aid needed to blunt this horrific crisis in Yemen. And I think President Biden was quite clear in saying that we're changing U.S. policy, that this was not being done because the United States had changed its view of the Houthis. Houthi rebels. And indeed, the Biden administration remains critical of attacks the Houthis have launched against U.S. partners, particularly Saudi Arabia, remains concerned about the Houthis' ties with Iran. And the Biden administration has justified the policy shift largely in terms of wanting to make sure that aid can continue to flow to average ordinary Yemenis.
So we're looking at a pivot here. We're looking at a continued U.S. presence. There's also what has been, Jim, the U.S. counterterror operation in Yemen, where one of the more lethal branches of al-Qaeda is based. That seems to be unchanged, unless I'm mistaken.
You're correct, Bob. The U.S. policy of going after al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula remains on course. Again, I wouldn't exaggerate the nature of the change that the Biden administration has made to U.S. policy toward Yemen. Again, as you point out, the counterterrorism mission remains unchanged. And also, aspects of U.S. support for the Saudi-led effort to unseat the Houthis has already been reduced over the years, the most important having been the U.S. willingness to refuel the anti-Houthi Saudi-led air forces in the air. That stopped, I think, back in November of 2018. And of course, the United States has already sold billions of dollars worth of weapons to the Saudis and the Emiratis over the past several years, weapons that are likely being used in the conflict. So the Biden administration has certainly heard from a number of critics who say what you've done is good, but it doesn't go far enough.
I would just add one more point, Jim, which we were just talking about the thicket of the Afghan peace talks. Yemen has its own peace process. I believe there's a UN envoy who's sort of in the center of it. That has not been going anyplace for a while. Do we anticipate maybe the U.S. playing a bigger role in trying to nudge that along through UN chambers and so forth?
That looks to be the case, Bob. I will note that Secretary of State Tony Blinken has already had calls with his counterpart in Saudi Arabia to talk about Yemen and a variety of other issues. And when President Biden unveiled this change in U.S. policy toward Yemen, he appointed Tim Lenderking as U.S. Special Envoy to Yemen. Lenderking most recently served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Iran, Iraq, and Regional Multilateral Affairs in the State Department. He also did a stint at the U.S. Embassy in Riyadh as Deputy Chief of Mission. So he knows the region well, and he particularly knows the Saudis. The question is, what is he going to be able to broker? And here you go from sort of the immediate issue of a civil war in Yemen, and you become embroiled in the broader context of regional politics. The Houthis get support from the Iranians. Obviously, the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Israelis, and the United States are greatly concerned about Iran, largely, but not solely, because of its nuclear activities. Again, Iran has been a malign actor in the region. I will note, however, that critics of U.S. policy would say because the United States has sided against the Houthis, that has left the Houthis with no choice but to look to Iran for help and aid, because it's the only possible avenue for them to get support. So we'll see whether Mr. Lenderking is going to succeed in his diplomacy. He's going to be operating, again, in a very difficult environment because there are lots of other larger political, geopolitical forces at play.
All right. We'll keep an eye on that one, Jim.
Bob, let's shift gears and talk about space. The upcoming week is going to be an exciting one in outer space. It's three different missions to Mars, one from the United States, a second from China, and a third from the United Arab Emirates, are all scheduled to either land on or orbit the red planet. When I woke up this morning, I saw that the Chinese mission had already reached Mars and was in orbit. You and I spoke last summer about the three countries' nearly simultaneous launches of missions to Mars. But can you tell us a bit more, Bob?
Sure, Jim. As listeners to the podcast know, we are always very eager to delve into space happenings. And this one, I think, really fits the bill. We're not stretching here, Jim. This is actually a legitimately big deal because of, in some cases, the unusual nature of it and the remote nature of it. 250 million miles, all three missions have traveled or will have traveled to get to Mars. They're all seeking different types of things, but they're all very interesting in their own way. The UAE has what it's called the HOPE orbiter that has already arrived now in orbit and is due to, among other things, focus on weather around Mars. So it has no intention of landing any equipment, but it's going to be taking weather readings and sort of taking stock of the Mars atmosphere. China has a mission called Tianwen-1 that's also entered orbit, as you noted, Jim. They are actually setting up, though, this, by the way, this is China's first independent interplanetary mission. They have plans to set up an actual landing on Mars with a rover. It's due to happen in around May. And then you have the U.S., which is no stranger to Mars. Mars. Again, another remotely piloted craft called Perseverance. And this is the Perseverance rover, I should say, that's going to arrive next week. So February 18th, it's due to arrive to land. And it's going to continue the U.S. mission of kind of collecting samples with a number of new sort of interesting and crucial bells and whistles. It'll have the ability to gauge audio with microphones on the rover. This will be a first, and audio soundings are considered to be important also for sort of gauging all sorts of things that scientists are able to gauge, like the width of certain materials, as well as what it sounds like on the surface of Mars on a given moment. It's also going to have a helicopter that it'll be able to pilot, and presumably we'll be seeing helicopter footage coming back from Mars.
Wait, Bob, I got to stop you there. A helicopter?
A helicopter, okay. Yes. If all goes well on the landing and it's not damaged, they'll be able to launch a helicopter that will be able to patrol around Mars.
Okay, but it's a helicopter in the sense it's really a drone. I mean, it's not a manned flight.
I would say think more like drone than, yes. There's no human, as yet, no human mission to Mars. There's all sorts of discussions and a little bit of planning going on, but these are all unmanned, as they say, unmanned, unmanned. And so the helicopter, though, will be sort of going through the Martian sky in ways that just we haven't done before. So again, it's adding to the experience of understanding what the surface of Mars is like, what its composition is like, and the crucial aspect, trying to find out whether it had in the past supported life. There have been new studies showing and new information showing that there was water present on Mars, and that is always a tantalizing glimpse into potential for life. They're going to be able to, they think with the samples taken in this next mission, be able to study further onto the molecular level and find out whether there were, you know, microbes that had once lived on Mars, for example. The other interesting thing is that the samples being collected are due to be returned at some point in a future mission back to the Earth. So the physical return of Martian rock samples coming back to Earth. That's interesting as well. So
that has never happened before?
That has never happened before, to my understanding. Now, there might be some out there who have other knowledge of this, but I'm pretty sure that's a first.
So what is the practical import of all this? I get national bragging rights, and I get the scientific consequence if you could find evidence of life or learn more about weather patterns and the like. Is there any practical consequence of these missions?
Again, thinking a bit far out, but increasingly the practical aspects are everything from, you know, what are the materials on Mars like? Are they materials that might be valuable back on Earth? We're starting to see that in relation to the moon and sort of the concept of mining the moon becoming more and more real. Maybe Mars, you know, also contains some elements that could be, if the materials unearthed by the latest rover are brought back successfully, maybe that's the start of something that gets to be much bigger. There's also the tantalizing aspect of, you know, sending human-occupied missions to Mars and having stations set up there and having them inhabited. And maybe Mars becomes a place that becomes part of a permanent outpost. The UAE is talking about 100 years or so down the road of having some sort of a human settlement on Mars. So I think it's first still a bit of discovery and the improved ability to launch into deeper space and to be able to do these types of things. It's really about pulling off the sort of maneuvers, I think, technically, to see if they can make this work. And then going on to this closest of planets that can be visited and seeing, you know, what it offers. It's always that sort of that broader sense, Jim, of kind of space as this opportunity and as a place to learn more about ourselves, maybe too.
The striking thing to me, Bob, is that we talked about these launches last July, which, if my math is correct, means it took 6 months to get from Earth to Mars, which suggests that going to Mars is not going to be a vacation-like experiment down the road. You're really talking about relocation.
Absolutely. And part of the thing that's going on now also is, and we've learned a little bit from the International Space Station studies going on, especially with the Kelly twins of the U.S., is that trying to understand what this does to the human body being in space that long and what impact, how the body can recover from it, how it's affected maybe permanently. As you say, it's a trip like no other and it's all learning. I don't think you're going to be seeing, again, human-occupied flights for quite some time, but it's still incredible and we're going to be seeing footage like we've never seen before. That's also interesting. The only other thing I would add is that it will be interesting to see whether we reach a point in the not-too-distant future where there's maybe more common cause instead of multiple missions. There have now been, I think, by my count, 5 different countries that have sent missions to the Mars orbit. Whether they just sort of, there's more of a combined effort and the world collectively comes together with a world Mars mission. That might be a bit pie in the sky, Jim, pardon the pun.
Well, the other alternative here, Bob, is not a mission led by governments either acting alone or together, but private industry. Obviously, Elon Musk has had a big space venture, Jeff Bezos the same way. And if I understand some of the press releases or talk about their efforts, that one of the things they have in mind far down the road is to find a way to get to Mars. So Mars has held appeal to human beings over the millennia. Certainly, our ancestors look up at the sky and notice the red planet, and it can continues to captivate today.
And meanwhile, there are already some pretty good movies and series out there about Mars. I would recommend people view The Martian by Ridley Scott. It's my favorite, but there's plenty of others coming out there.
And I will just note, while people are dreaming of going to Mars or to the moon, I would just like to be in a situation where I could travel to the beach and go on vacation.
Fair enough. Well, back on Earth, we're pursuing the audience figure of the week, Jim. Listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. And this week, CFR.org's audience selected 1+ million Venezuelan refugees as the figure of the week. Jim, why is that significant?
It's significant, Bob, because it represents a historic movement to deal with a major refugee crisis. Let's take a step back. Back in 2016, Venezuela had roughly 31 million citizens. In the 5 years since then, more than 5 million Venezuelans have fled the country because of the absolute mess that Nicolas Maduro and his allies have made of Venezuela. Of those 5 million people, something on the order of a third of them, or about 1.7 million Venezuelans, ended up in neighboring Colombia. As you can imagine, Bob, that has put a tremendous amount of pressure on Colombia, which is a country coming out of a 50-year civil war that has many of its own divisions and problems to deal with. Now, something on the order of half of the Venezuelans who've come to Colombia don't have a legal right to be there. And what President Iván Duque of Colombia did this week is provide a legal basis for them to stay and remain in Colombia. Under the measure, the decision that President Duque made, those who've entered Colombia without permission before the end of last month are eligible to get legal status. And those who are in Colombia who already have legal status will now be free for at least a decade to operate and live legally, above board, to work in Colombia. So this is significant. I'll note that the head of the UN Refugee Agency, Filippo Grande, called it the most important humanitarian gesture in the region in decades. It is significant not just for Latin America, but when you look at the world more broadly. There is something on the order of 60 to 80 million refugees worldwide. This is a major problem. But as we talked about numerous times in the podcast, Bob, a lot of governments have turned their back on refugees, arguing they can't take any more, that there's domestic opposition to taking more. So in that context, what it is that President Duque has done is quite significant.
I agree, Jim. I think it's pretty extraordinary. I had to kind of look twice when I saw the reports on that come in because it does run so counter to the trends. I mean, even in the U.S., where you've seen a change, the Biden administration announcing it was lifting the ceilings on refugees from around 15,000 or so that it reached under the Trump administration to like 120,000. It still pales in comparison to what Colombia is doing. But do we have any sense, Jim, the Colombian public okay with this? Is there pushback? Is President Duque finding some problems on that front?
Well, as always the case in any country, Bob, you're going to find people who favored the move and people who opposed it. One thing that aids President Duque on this is that for many Colombians have spent time in Venezuela, maybe related to people who've come over, so that eases it. But it obviously puts a major pressure on politics within Colombia, which are, as in many countries, already complicated. We've talked before on the podcast about ending the civil war and the sort of fraying of that epic peace agreement. But it's also in some ways a recognition by President Duque of the reality he faces. There are, again, 1.7 million Venezuelan refugees in Colombia, and they're not going to go back to Venezuela. If you try to force them back to Venezuela, that would create massive problems. So here is a president, a leader of a country looking to find a way to sort of work with the problem that has been handed to him. And again, the numbers are quite large. And you just mentioned the Biden administration changing the policy from the Trump administration. And if the Biden administration has its ways, the number will go up to a ceiling of 125,000 refugees a year, which is roughly what it was before the Trump administration came into office. But I think if you sort of look in the weeks and months to come, the Biden administration is going to face considerable political challenges over what looks to be a looming immigration refugee crisis at its own border. I'll note that the number of people arrested trying to come into the United States across the southern border was up 6% in January alone. I think they're members of the Biden administration that are seeing trends indicating that those numbers are likely to increase. It's coming in part because people are leaving Central America, which has been devastated by poverty. poverty and violence, but also by climate change and two major hurricanes that have further complicated issues there. But we're also seeing more Mexican citizens trying to cross the border. And they're doing so in part because of the sense that the Biden administration will be more lenient than the Trump administration was, and partly because you have coyotes, these people who profit over the human trafficking, going out and telling people this. And so that's going to put, for the Biden administration, a major problem on the plate when it has lots of other issues to deal with, both domestically and in foreign policy. And I will note that President Biden has said this, and he said it back on the campaign. For the United States, it's not simply a matter of the number of refugees, but trying to fix the system by which we process refugees who make asylum applications, because it's long and convoluted. But it's also about trying to address the causes that lead people to come to the United States. President Biden had big expectations for investing in the Northern Triangle, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, where a lot of the people are coming from or claiming asylum. But it's not clear he's going to be able to get Congress on board with that. So these are big problems. They have complicated roots, and they're horrific to watch. They also create real big political problems at home.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. A string of notable holidays hits this coming week. Asian countries are marking the Lunar New Year. The U.S. marks Valentine's Day plus President's Day. And Catholic nations and others celebrate Mardi Gras and the Carnival before Lent.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlin. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge and Bethany Wright for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrera and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and be safe out there.